If you have a big question, the number is 747-5877, or you can email your question to news@kcaw.org, or you can do what Stephen did and post your question on the Raven Radio Facebook page on the thread for this forum. It's 13 minutes after 7 o'clock. You are listening to a live election forum with school board candidates Ed Gray and Jennifer McNichol. This is the first of four candidate forums, or first of four election forums we'll be doing this week. We've got assembly candidates in at this time tomorrow, mayoral candidates in on Wednesday. And Thursday, we're going to have a conversation about the ballot question on property taxes. All the forums start at 6:30. We'd really love to hear from you, 747-5877. Jennifer, I want to circle back to something you were saying about funding. And unless somebody calls, I have a lot of boring questions about funding and things. But there is a connection between the federal Title I grants. Sitka District gets $900,000, over $900,000 in Title I grants, which do require an assessment of some kind. I went to the Department of Education website, and it said more than 56,000 public schools across the country use Title I funds to provide additional academic support and learning opportunities to help low-achieving children master challenging curricula and meet state standards in core academic subjects. And I called the district, and I said, what does that mean exactly? And Cassie Olin said that you have to pass some kind of assessment to do that. So there is that. And since we were sort of on the idea, the AMP testing, the Alaska Measures of Progress, which every parent who had a kid in school last year knows, the AMP testing kind of collapsed due to problems with the internet. There were technical bugs, and we don't have testing this year, and we won't have it until 2018. What steps, if any, should the district take to measure student performance? I mean, what do we do? As a board, have you addressed it, Jennifer? And has anybody?
We've not addressed that specific question as a board yet, because there's still so much that's in the air. I know that, you know, the district administrators, the district test coordinator is, you know, is Assistant Superintendent Sarah Ferency, and I know that's certainly a big item on her plate to address, because, yeah, we have no way of assessing, you know, checking in on how kids are doing with standards, whether they're making progress. There's just kind of a big gaping hole and a lot of uncertainty right now between what just fell apart and what's going to come in its place. It's a big problem right now.
All right. I thought we had a call. Scotty, if you would like to come back onto the forum, please give us another call again, and we'll try and get you on the air. Ed Gray, what should the district do to, if at all, to assess its students right now?
Yeah, the district, in the education law that we just passed, which the governor allowed to become law on July 28th and becomes active on October 28th, what we did was we put a moratorium on testing to 2018 with a deadline of 2020 to resume testing. And when the AMP testing was initially started, myself and a number of other people, we opposed, you know, we told parents simply don't, it's an invalid test. Your students are all going to fail. You know, refuse it. Because as parents with students, I mean, we have an obligation to demand, you know, valid testing. And we should not allow our children to take invalid tests. Now, we canceled the AMPs after you know, the technical problems they didn't have this year, but it was the last year for testing. They were canceled anyway. They're going to end. Of the states that started Common Core testing, 30 states besides Alaska have opted out of the Common Core test they were using. So this is not just Alaska. This is nationwide. And it's all for the same reason. It's that these are invalid tests that don't measure our students' academic achievement. Even the calls to the commissioner about it. You know, when he was explaining, he was in town and gave a presentation and was explaining results. You know, he said that okay, well, it doesn't mean anything. You know, to your children, it's about rating schools. It's about rating teachers. Okay, this is not a reason to take tests. So if there's going to be tests, they should be tests that are determined locally. We should decide as a community, our teachers, our local education experts, you know, parents. We should decide what measure that we want to use to measure our children's academic achievement by using validated assessments.
Do you have a response to that, Jennifer?
it's such a loaded topic. I think, you know, this all goes back to new standards being adopted. And then, you know, the way that you assess your progress with new standards and then the new curricula that follows new standards is to assess how well they're being, you know, what's the progress that's being made in learning and acquiring and progressing along in these standards from grade to grade. I think that, you know, obviously we don't want lots of time spent on testing. We don't want lots of time spent on preparation and teaching to the test. I think there's a lot of recognition now that linking teacher performance and teacher evaluations to test results is a very fraught with a lot of problems and should not be, you know, the main factor in determining teacher performance. As new standards are developed, though, new assessments unfortunately have to be developed, and clearly there are a lot of rollout problems with the AMP test and with the two Common Core based tests that have been used nationally and that some states have now backed out of using. You know, unfortunately, it's all a work in progress, and you know, I think it's unfortunate that things had to happen on such a fast time scale. I think in Alaska, there was this kind of, you know, hurry up to assess event that happened that ended up with, you know, rushing test development and then rushing implementation and then all sorts of logistical problems, which I think were much more prominent than content problems with the tests. You know, I think reality is that assessments are important. They're a tool. They should not be the primary focus and linking again funding and you know teacher performance status to them creates a lot of problems. I think the pendulum is kind of swinging away, you know, and there's a lot of recognition that obviously too much testing is a bad thing. And that's been recognized on the federal level as well. I think it's still a work in progress, and I think things will settle out eventually to a point where we're getting some useful data, useful information that helps tailor and modify educational standards and curricula over time, but you know, just like adopting any drastically different new program, you run into a lot of issues with implementation. You know, my analogy would be, you know, I've been a physician for 20 years. I learned to document everything on paper. And now we are, you know, virtually paper free. And that's happened fairly suddenly, at least in my life, over the last four or five years. And it was a pretty rude awakening to suddenly be documenting everything in an electronic health record. But looking back, I realize, you know, this is a much better system. Things are much more organized, and other providers can find records on my patients much more readily, and I can do the same for theirs. So, you know, yeah, it is, it's the way to go, but the period of implementation and the learning curve can be steep and painful.
Thanks, Jennifer McNichol. Ed Gray, I wanted to ask you one thing that Jennifer mentioned that is now gone along with AMP, is this teacher and administrative accountability aren't linked any longer to performance on the AMP or any other test. Should we look for another objective way to evaluate instruction?
Yeah, I don't, you know, when you start defining learning as performance on a test, which is what you do in standardized testing, you're corrupting education. I'm not a fan of standardized testing. So why do we standardize tests? It's because what? Accountability? Because we need the data. You know, standardized testing, it tells you basically, you know, historically, all it's ever told you is what percentage of low socioeconomic children you have in your district. I mean, that's historically what standardized testing tells you.
Ed, what about teachers? How do we evaluate teaching through if we don't have standardized testing?
We evaluate teachers at the local level. We evaluate teachers by their performance at the local level. You know, again, I just got to go back to it. It's like if we have local control of our school districts, we can make decisions about hiring and firing and evaluating and testing and see. We should be making those decisions at the local level. And as far as like a new system, you know, for the last 200 and whatever years, we've had local control over education. You know, your generation and my generation, there were 250,000 independent school districts, and that system worked out okay. I mean, we've done okay. Now, because our students don't standardize test as well as, you know, we standardize test 100% of our students. All the other countries standardize the top 10% of their students. So because our students don't do as well on standardized testing as other country, suddenly our education system is being called a failure. And I just dispute that. It's not a failure. I mean, my goal is not that my children do well on standardized tests. That's not what I consider a successful education. So we can evaluate at the local level. We can evaluate any way we want. We can hire, fire. We can use any evaluation system that we want. That's why I'm so against nationalized education. That's why I'm so opposed to FedEd and such a proponent of local control.
The number to call is 747-5877 if you have a question for our school board candidates. Ed Gray, thanks for your answer, Ed, and Jennifer McNichol. You can also email a question to news@kcaw.org. You can also post a question on our Raven Radio Facebook page on the thread for this forum. Ed Gray, there's another question about the meme. Some questions came in last year when you were running as well, when this incident occurred, and I hadn't seen the meme, and I didn't know it was real, but this resident Paul would like to know, will you explicitly denounce the insult to Mary Wegner that was posted by you, not some shadowy troll from out of town, and you own it until you disown it?
Yeah, I posted the meme on Sick of Chatters. Now I got the meme, and you know, and yeah, I don't remember exactly what it said, but you know, but what you said about it, I didn't realize the picture. I didn't realize the Photoshop picture had been picture of Mary Wegner, but I saw the meme. And I understood, I understood the story behind it, what it was about, and I posted it. I don't know what he's asking. If he wants me to denounce the
insult to Mary Wegner.
The insult to Mary Wegner. No, I understood the meme. I understood the meme, the story behind it.
I guess my follow-up question is, if you're elected, do you think you'd be able to work with our superintendent?
When our superintendent was hired, you know, I went to the hirings. I'd been, I kind of paid attention to the process, the hiring process. And I had a pretty close relationship with Steve Bradshaw, you know, over the years. I worked pretty close with him, and we had a good relationship. I worked well with him. And so in the course of that, I got to know Mary Wegner. I met with her a number of times. Actually, initially, she asked me to be part of her team, a lobbyist. She asked me to be on her team as a lobbyist. She wanted to bring me on board. Because we knew each other, we'd had a number of conversations over her time here and my activities in the school district. And so at the hiring, I opposed her hiring. I was opposed to her. I was opposed to her, you know, her direction I was opposed to the direction she wanted to take the school district. It was just opposed to what I saw and how the school district had been going. So at her hiring, I opposed her being hired. I still continue to think that she wasn't the 20th best candidate for the job. That the reason she was hired was. Which I don't think anybody would dispute. I mean, I've talked to board members about this. They say, well, she was hired for her technical abilities, you know, because we're moving into this, you know, we're moving into technology and we need somebody to implement technology. And actually, Mary said herself that to me, that you know, she said, well, I was hired to implement. But overall, yeah, I didn't like her. I didn't like the direction that she wanted to take the school district. I didn't like how she saw education, and so I opposed her hiring. Now there's a lot of people there, and there's only one person that opposed her hiring, and that was me. And I don't like where she's taken, you know, where the direction she's going with the school district. She is the most pro Fed Ed superintendent in the state. I am 100% opposed to Fed Ed, and so. I'm opposed to most everything that she's done with the school district in relation to that. Now I'm not going out of my way to find fault with the school district or find fault with her. She is qualified at things. She does some good things, but no, I don't like what she's doing as a superintendent. Could I work with her? I could work with her. Would I want to replace her? I would want to replace her with someone who was vested in the community, someone that was vested in local control, someone that was vested in children, you know, rather than this being vested in Fed Ed. I don't want a superintendent that's invested in Fed Ed. I want a superintendent that's invested in Sitka, I want somebody whose priority is the academic achievement and of our children. I don't want somebody whose priority is implementing FedEd. So could I work with her? Yes. Would I want to see someone who would promote local control? Yeah, I would rather have a superintendent that would do that.
Do you have a response to that, Jennifer, or would you like a new question?
I mean, there's only currently serving on the board. You know, Dr. Wegner is our only employee. So just as far as in that relationship, I'm not going to, you know, comment on character and you know, all these other areas. I, you know, she's our superintendent. I think we all currently work well with her, and I think that's extremely important to be able to work together as a group on the board and to also be able to work with your employee, who is the superintendent, and I think we do that well at this point.
All right. The number is 747-5877. If you have a question for our school board candidates, you can also email a question to news@kcaw.org or do what Paul and Stephen have done and post a question on this thread on the Raven Radio Facebook page. New question, new topic. The Sitka High Symphonic Band is one of five bands selected to perform at the Northwest National Association for Music Education Conference. It's a big honor, but $60,000 expense to send 55 students. It's about a little over $1,000 per student. It's going to be some fundraising. It's going to be a huge out-of-pocket expense for families. But it's also not exclusive to music. There are there's the Costa Rica trip the Spanish class is taking. That's $2,400 per student. This is sort of the extreme end of the activities expense. But if you just want to be on the cross-country team, there's an activities fee. If you want to go out for a sport, there's an activities fee. Maybe it's $100 or $200. And I wondered if we have unrealistic expectations for activities in our district now, and you guys both as parents are feeling this more than I am. You know, I'm finally out of it, but I wonder, are we creating inequities in an education system that's supposed to be open to all by imposing these kinds of fees and having these very expensive activities?
Well, I think as a community, you know, we've made our interests and our priorities known. You know, this community supports arts and supports music and supports athletics and supports drama and debate and, you know, mock trial. These things all, actually all of these activities rise up out of people wanting them, people creating them. They're not top down. You know, they're not driven by the board or district administrator saying, you know, hey, let's get a mock trial team going, or let's send our symphonic band to this conference in Washington. It's all, you know, rising up from what students want and request. So it's important to recognize that it's community driven, and unfortunately, to a large extent, it needs to be community supported. Or there will be, you know, attrition you know, events fall by the wayside. I have huge concerns about the inequity of, you know, kids being able to participate. And I've spent, you know, one of the reasons I got involved with the school board was because I became involved as a parent with the activities committee, which is, I guess, a committee that came out of the school board, but it's a kind of an ad hoc group of parents and administrators and teachers and coaches and school board members trying to, you know, come up with ideas to make activities sustainable and equitable. And, you know, so far there haven't been any great revelations, but that certainly is our focus. That's what our, when we talk about, you know, what would we do if we can, you know, come up with some new funding source, how are we going to divvy that up amongst the activities at the high school, for example? You know, will it go towards funding travel for teams and activities that qualify for these expensive out-of-town events, whether it's, you know, state championship travel or like the symphonic band's travel? or do we just spread it amongst everybody that's participating, you know, including the kids who are not going to state, you know? So cross country is an example I'm intimately familiar with. You know, 7 kids out of that team get to travel to state if they qualify for state at regions. That leaves, you know, the remainder of the team cheering them on, you know, from here, but not traveling to state. So is it equitable for those 7 kids to have their travel subsidized versus having, you know, the 25, 30 kids have reduced activity fees? It's a discussion that we go around and around on because there's a lot of ways to look at it. I don't have the answers, and I don't think I should. I think it should be a community discussion, and it should come out of what we want, you know, what we prioritize as a community. But I think it's something that should be on all of our radar. You know, this community does support activities in incredible ways, both financially and by showing up and cheering kids on and even traveling out of town to support kids. So clearly there is support, and we need to recognize that, but also maybe try to channel it a little bit into figuring out what the priorities are and how we're going to sustain things, and when do we need to make hard choices as a school board on, you know, sanctioning activities and continuing to authorize things to occur. There's were discussions long before I was on the board about, you know, adding new activities, and that has engendered a lot of continuing discussion since then.
All right. Thanks, Jennifer McNichol. Ed Gray, do you think the high cost of activities is creating inequity in our school system, which should be open to everyone?
Yeah. I think it, of course it does. It, you know, school education itself reveals inequities. 75% of students do fine. You know, 25% of students that, you know, that come from lower socioeconomic backgrounds don't achieve as well. So the inequity we see in education, you know, as well. And I think that, you know, these activities we're talking about, they're completely, you know, developmentally appropriate, age appropriate activities that we should continue to support and you know, push. We should push in our schools. You know, we've cut activities too far already. We've sacrificed too much already. Schools should be supporting these activities. Is there going to be, you know, there's a disparity in education. If some child's parents are more successful, they're going to have opportunities that other children don't have, you know, that lower socioeconomic children don't have. That's just reality. Can you change that? You can't really change it. It's just the way it is. It's you know, it's the way it always is. It's always been. So I don't we give every child, you know, the best opportunities we can. They're not all going to have the same results, you know. I mean, if it costs a lot to do an activity, and a child's parents, you know, are unable to support that, it's not going to happen. You know, it doesn't mean they can't do anything. I mean, everyone has to be given the same opportunity. Will everybody be able to, you know, achieve the same result? They're not going to be able to, and there really isn't. We can't solve that problem. I mean, there's nothing that, you know, school board members can do about that.
I think you guys spaced your kids better. I had 2 kids in high school. Well, you've got 1 year of 2 kids in high school, both of you.
Yep.
So, I found it was kind of, it was just like for a while there, a couple of years, it was double your fun on fees and things. And I know that there have got to be like single income families that in my same situation that are just like, finding that quite high. Well, anyway, I'm glad it's on your radars. I had a question about teachers. The number to call, by the way, is 747-5877 or email news@kcaw.org, or you can post a question online at the Raven Radio Facebook page on this forum thread. I wanted to talk a little bit about teaching. Ed, you have the first question. The teachers' union agreed to no pay raise this year, but will take pay hikes in each of the next 2 years. Do you think the district took a strong enough negotiating position with teachers? And would you ever consider a pay cut?
I wasn't involved in the process, and so I can't really comment on the process. I don't know. As to pay cuts, I haven't been involved in, having not been involved in those negotiations. It's just really hard for me to answer the question, to be honest with you. I would have to participate. I would have to be there, to really see how it plays out. I'm extremely worried about, our teachers. I know that, nationally, going to this individual certified teacher, using people that apply for a job and then certifying them on the spot, or replacing certified teachers, that's being done nationally. And going into this, going to a technology-based, competency-based, system with teacherless schools is a reality that I see that we're going to be facing in a handful of years. I see that as a reality because it's happening nationally. So I'm really concerned about teachers. Our teachers are our local education experts. They are who should be, who should be determining how we're educating our kids locally.
Oh, hold that thought, Ed. I have another question on exactly that subject. Okay. But before we stray too far, I want to have Jennifer's response to, did the district take a strong enough negotiating position with teachers, and would you ever consider a pay cut?
So this was the first time I've been involved in union contract negotiations, and it was, basically to get briefed and then kind of approve or give feedback on, where we wanted those negotiations to go. I thought they went very well. I think the teachers union is to be commended for, agreeing to no hike in the next year and really pretty low cuts compared with, or low raises in the next subsequent 2 years. I think we can all agree that teachers have, virtually the most important or one of the most important jobs in our society, and yet they are certainly not proportionately paid compared with others. So I have a hard time going to hardball with educators that are already agreeing to, pretty restrictive terms. I don't think we should have played harder ball than we did play.
And the follow-up question that I was alluding to, do you think the district, other than financially, what are some ways the school board can support teachers?
Well, everything costs money. Yeah. Professional development is a big, aspect of what teachers want and what teachers need, and that does cost money. Both in terms of time and in terms of, the actual products. So aside from that, I think just, supporting their efforts, recognizing their efforts, pointing out the great things that happen as they happen, telling the story of what goes on every day in the Sitka schools is a really important part of what everyone needs to do, but I think as school board members, we can be a big part of that. and, you know, participating where we can, being aware, making ourselves available and aware of what's happening, but also, you know, being a conduit, you know, between the community and the teachers and the administration. As board members, you know, we are all have a school that we're a liaison to, and I think that's a really important role, and I've really enjoyed that in the past year, being able to participate in activities in given schools, and I know other board members do as well. You know, Dr. Conley has regaled us with many stories of entertaining activities that he's participated in at Baranoff School, for example. So I think being, you know, actively involved and showing our interest and not just, you know, being people who show up once or twice a month to sit down at a meeting for a couple of hours, but actually being involved with the schools face-to-face and meeting kids and meeting educators face-to-face is really important.
All right. Thank you, Jennifer McNichol. Ed Gray, getting back, you got us into this. What should the school board do to support teachers other than financially, other than salaries? What do you see your role as a school board member in supporting teachers?
Yeah, you know, I have to go back to, I think the best thing that the school board can do, you know, and it's the work that I've been doing for the last, you know, 2 or 3 years, is to work at the state level to basically regain local control and get local control of education. The Fed Ed plan for teachers is basically, you know, to have teacherless schools, is to not have teachers. And this has already happened nationally. I mean, we're taking teachers, certified teachers. You know, when I say teacherless, I'm talking about the certified teachers that we have there now teaching school, our local education experts. You know, they're replacing them, you know, with certified hires. And these technologically delivered competency based curriculums, and so the best thing we can do for our teachers as a school board member is it's the same work I'm doing now, is to work with the state to get state and local control of education, where we can, as a local community, we can look at, you know, the educational resources we have. We can take, you know, the finances, the money that we have. You know, we can decide, you know, make local decisions about what portion of that we can spend on teachers and how many teachers. And we can locally, you know, hire, fire teachers and evaluate teachers and assess teachers. And we can do it as a community. I mean, we as a community locally have much greater stake in our teachers than the feds do. They're our schools. These are our teachers teaching our children. We have a big stake in this. So you know, so the best thing as a school board member would be to do the same work that I've been doing, is working with the state to ensure that we can locally control the overseeing of our districts and our teachers.
All right. Thanks, Ed. You have a response, Jennifer?
Not so much a response, but something that occurred to me as far as, you know, how as a school board we support teachers, just involving them in decisions, as Ed was talking about, with, you know, local control. And our teachers are intimately involved in our decisions and inform a lot of our decisions. And I think that's a really important role that they play and that we need to foster. You know, I've only been on the board for the past year, so I've not been involved intimately in some of the curriculum development and adoption of standards that happened, you know, over the last 4 years or so. But, you know, reviewing the process that was used both for English language arts and for math, you know, it was very teacher-driven. You know, retired teachers Bob Petruski and Lyle Sparrowgrove, respectively, for ELA and for math, were in charge of, you know, the committees that reviewed standards and then recommended the standards to adopt, and then, you know, reviewed instructional materials and tested them, and you know, went through this really exhaustive process. It was really impressive to kind of learn the timeline and the work that went into the recommendations that then came out largely of the teachers, with some, you know, some parent and community input as well. So I think that's actually a critically important way that, that we respect teachers and involve teachers and make our district better. And that's been happening. So I hope to keep that going and foster more of that.
All right. Thank you, Jennifer. You're listening to School Board Candidates Ed Gray and Jennifer McNichol. The number to call is 747-5877, or you can email news@kcaw.org or post a comment on our Facebook thread at Raven Radio's Facebook page. This is the first of four election forums that we'll have this week. Assembly candidates tomorrow, mayoral candidates on Wednesday, and then we'll have a ballot proposition discussion at this time on Thursday. We have another question coming in through Facebook, and it's addressed to Ed, but I'm sure you guys will both want to answer it because the school district just took up this topic at its last meeting. But it says, it's from Christine. It says, Mr. Gray has opposed education on healthy relationships and sex ed in the schools. And you can frame your opposition, Ed. I realize this is a kind of a very generalization of what you were attempting. I heard him say that he believes that the home is where this education should occur. What does he suggest for the children and teens who will not receive that level of communication and support at home? And we are down to just a very few minutes to go here. And
yeah, my opposition to the program that we're talking
Ed
about.
Ed Blatchley.
Yeah, was I don't remember the name of it now, but was based on. First of all, that, you know, Planned Parenthood was teaching it, and an organization that's the largest abortion provider in the United States, an organization that aborts 900 babies a day, you know, I just didn't see that as a gateway to, you know, to human sexuality education for our children. I didn't see the connection, didn't make the connection. They didn't share my values. They don't share a lot of people's values, and so my opposition was based on that and the, you know, and the, you know, the philosophy that, you know, that human sexuality, you know, is a non-family enterprise. You know, I believe it very much is a family enterprise. And so the efforts I partook from there was to create a system where parents were involved in human sexuality education, and that's the result we came up with. The result we came up with is that parents get to be involved in whatever human sexuality is taught in the schools. Now, nothing I did prohibited the teaching of human sexuality in the schools. That's not part of it. That's not something I ever undertook to do. So again, the main issues I wanted to address was Planned Parenthood teaching it, and that it was a, you know, that it was being done as a non-family enterprise. I wanted families involved in that.
All right. Thanks, Ed Gray. Jennifer McNichol, the question was, what do we do for children and teens who don't have the kind of family support for this particular kind of education?
I think obviously we need to provide the resources that they need that they're not getting at home. You know, in my profession, I see the results of kids not being informed and not understanding the implications of, you know, some of the decisions that they make as impulsive adolescents. And they can have lifelong repercussions, both, you know, in many ways, as we all know. And a lot of that comes from not getting those lessons at home, unfortunately. Yes, ideally you learn about relationships and sexual health in a healthy environment, you know, both by just how your family operates and how it exists and what you see, you know, modeled as far as healthy relationships go. But, you know, we all know the sad truth is that that is not 100%. That's not uniform. There are many, many young people in this community and in all communities that do not come from homes where healthy relationships are being demonstrated, or where someone's taking the time to consistently, you know, provide the education that we hope they're getting. There are kids who are, you know, couch surfing, who don't really even have a home. And those are often the kids who are at highest risk of being, you know, victims and being drawn into unhealthy relationships where unfortunate things end up happening. We need to, you know, address 100% of the kids. You know, if a family has a strong objection to the depth of the conversation, then, you know, they always have the option of removing their child from that lesson. And there needs to be, you know, good communication between the schools and the families so that everyone understands what's going on. I had kids at Blatchley at the time of what Mr. Gray's talking about, and my understanding was that, you know, we live in a small town, and as far as the people that are trained in teaching the curriculum that was felt to be the appropriate curriculum, you know, there's limited choices. So, you know, the individual who had that training also worked part-time for Planned Parenthood. It was not a Planned Parenthood-sponsored program. The kids were not being encouraged to have abortions. You know, that was not the content. And I think, you know, the problem with House Bill 156, which is the law that comes into effect in October, it, you know, severely limits the options for who can provide those lessons. And it ties the hands behind the backs of districts in trying to find people who are qualified and available, especially in some of the, you know, really small villages. It's the consequences could be devastating as far as, you know, we already have amongst the highest chlamydia and gonorrhea rates in the nation. And I don't see that getting any better anytime soon if kids are not being taught about sexual health and, you know, how to be healthy.
All right. Thank you, Jennifer McNichol.